welcome back, or welcome to the On Coaching Podcast. I'm Steve Magnus, joined by my good friend and colleague and fellow coach, Jonathan Marcus. John, what's going on, my man?
Let's go. You know what time it is. It's time to give the people what we want. And we're back. Part two of this delicious two-part series of The Wall. And today, the bear.
Yes. Time to nerd out and go deep. If you like explanations, if you like understanding things to the nth degree, this podcast is for you. And you know what? If you like understanding things, you know what else is for you?
Steve, tell me what?
The scholar program. Because
yes!
We go deep on everything in terms of the science, the history, the art, training of the best. Right now, as you probably have heard, we're in the middle of our Canovathon where we're just plowing through things. You know, one of our members sent a email to me the other day, and it simply said, I am overwhelmed by how much Canova information and training plans and actual training this is awesome. It's gonna last me like 3 years.
Fun fact, I was talking to Mike Smith the other day, and he's like, man, I was up until 1 a.m. just plowing through that Canova stuff. I lost track of time. And this is a guy who's getting ready for NCAA championship for track, and he's, you know, up till 1 a.m. just researching. It's there. It's great. Oh, my goodness. You're missing out if you're not a scholar. Sign up today.
And you know what? We still have, I kid you not, like 34 training logs of athletes.
Yeah. Yes. So phenomenal.
It's amazing. All right, so let's dive into this week. Last time we talked about the wall, which is, you know, hitting the wall in the longer events, running out of glycogen, fuel usage, all that stuff. We were gonna talk about the bear, but we went on about the wall for an hour plus, diving into science. And this week we're gonna talk about the bear. What is the bear, to refresh you guys? Well, if you think about it on the track events, especially in the middle of distance events, it is when the bear jumps on your back. You feel like your coordination is losing. You feel like you're not being able to, your muscles are no longer working. Your body is filled with, we'll call it, quote unquote, lactic. And you're just shutting down, right? And you're just shutting down. And sometimes as a coach or fan or athlete, you can watch people and you just see their body. It's almost like they disintegrate. I was watching NCAAs, because we're recording this during NCAAs, watching it, you know, the prelims, and it's amazing. That last 100, especially of some of those 800s and 1500s, where people are looking good, and then bear jumps on their back. They start going backwards. They start swimming with their arms to try and compensate, right? And it's just not a fun experience. So we're going to talk about a little bit of why that happens and what you can do about it.
Yeah, it's pretty brutal to watch. And, you know, that's why, again, the wall, we got to remember, is a slow, steady decline in performance, versus the bear is a sharp and sudden, abrasive reversal in performance ability, where Steve said that they look good, and then all of a sudden, ooh, looking ugly.
Yep, exactly. So I think to set the stage, since we go deep here, I'm gonna just give our listeners a refresher on muscle contraction.
Yes.
Okay. And it's been a while since I've gone through this stuff, so bear with me if I get any minor details wrong. But what we're gonna talk about really quickly, because this is crucial to understand what acidosis does to your body, because acidosis interferes with this, okay? And acidosis is kind of what the bear is all about. So what is muscle contraction? Well, you can kind of break it down. If you're looking at the best theory is the cross bridge theory, which sliding filament theory, which is essentially, if you think of it as if we're playing tug of war, right? And you have, you know, your left arm and your right arm are on there pulling, and then sometimes you move that right arm in front of that left arm to pull some more, and then you switch it off. You switch back and forth. That's what's happening in the muscle when it contracts, right? We have these little myosin heads, which pull on this actin component of the muscle like we're playing tug of war. And as it pulls, that's what happens. The muscle contracts, right? And in order for that pulling to happen, a couple things have to occur, okay? So we have, first we have calcium that binds to this actin site, which almost like frees it up and says, okay, calcium binds, frees up this space where, we'll use the analogy, you can put your arm to pull. That's what happens. This myosin head binds to this place where the calcium freed it up. You have ADP and phosphate, okay, on this myosin head. When it pulls its energy, it's like breaking apart, it releases, right? So ADP and phosphate release. And then, you know, you pulled, and then that arm releases to go reach for the next one. But in order for it to reach to the next one, right, you have to refill that energy so that you have the energy to pull again. So you have to refill that ADP and phosphate kind of. So what happens, that's where ATP, which is essentially ADP and phosphate, triphosphate. What happens is that ATP comes in and then allows you to repeat that cycle again, okay? Puts you in this position. So what does that mean? ATP, okay, is the energy source that we are replacing, utilizing, etc. when we think of breaking down glycogen all the way down into restoring that ATP. Or if we think of it as, you know, fatty acids, takes a little bit longer route to do that. But eventually we get to the same thing, restoring that energy thing. Okay, so what? Okay, so we've got a couple components here. And just to refresh, and I know we're going deep here, but we've got this calcium that kind of says, hey, here's a free spot. You can grab on here. We've got the myosin head with ADP and phosphate that grab on. ADP and phosphate let go. We got to restore that with ATP. Okay. What does acidosis have to do and play into this? Well, acidosis interferes with that process. Okay. The lower the pH goes, the more the difficult it becomes in a couple different areas. A, that it becomes difficult for that calcium to do its job and clear the space. Okay. And then B, it becomes difficult, which is kind of related, but I'm trying to keep it moderately simple. It becomes difficult for, we'll call it that myosin head to get a grip on the rope, right, to pull. Okay. And then as we run out of fuel and stuff like that, it becomes difficult to replace that ATP fast enough. But when we're looking at acidosis, we're really looking at, I almost like to call it as, it's almost like putting sludge onto the rope or onto the system, where it's like, oh man, this isn't easy to do anymore. This isn't easy to like bind to. This isn't easy to grab upon. This isn't easy to let go and try and, you know, move my hand up to it. It's almost like this sticky, sludgy substance, you know, in this analogy, that makes it really freaking hard. So the more acidosis that happens, the more that our pH drops, okay, the harder it becomes. There was a nice research study in 2018 that looked at this exact process in the muscle force. And I'm just going to quote it real quick, and I'll put this link in the show notes for those who want to go even deeper. But it says, essentially, decrease in pH reduces myosin's detachment from actin, so that letting go, so that you can, you know, move your hand up to pull, by slowing that ADP release, right? That ADP and phosphate can't break apart. It's quick, so you can't detach. And it increases the non-productive myosin binding, okay, which means difficulty in grabbing and letting go, and reduces myosin's attachment to actin by slowing the weak to strong binding transition. What does all that jumbled mess mean? Exactly what we talked about just a second ago. If you think of it as this tug of war, You're having trouble grasping onto it and letting go to move to the next spot. All of that combines into what? Less muscle contraction, less force and power, and eventually that shutting down, that slowing down, that falling apart that we often see in running. So that's, we just zoomed all the way into the kind of microscopic muscle part of this to give you an idea of what's going on and why people, you know, where the, at one level, the biochemistry of fatigue occurs.
It's, yeah, physiology 101. You know, if you want, you can always go take AP 101 type course and, you know, get a little bit more familiar with actin, myosin, and how those cross bridges and things interact. But I think that's the best way to think about it, Steve, is it's an interference, right? And the goal is the reason the bear jumps on someone's back when they're sprinting or when they're running fast, like in the more in the middle distance, the eights, the 15s, and you see it a lot more in the four, right? The open four, is because the power you're trying to generate as an athlete with each step, the power you're trying to create to hit the ground with forceful contraction, forceful foot strikes, and then create propulsion forward so you can then get that opposite and equal return of flying forward in that sprint is very, very high. So the concept is, well, for speed reserve, right? The reason we do speed work with lots of recovery in between, and then we're talking rest, not jog, you know, just doing nothing, is because what you're trying to do when you do pure speed is you're just trying to increase the power, the ultimate power capacity that those muscles can contract. So that's why we do pure speed at no longer than about 10 seconds. So that first round of ATP, right, on that anaerobic cycle is used and we're done. That's it. But when we're doing speed endurance or when we do lactate tolerance type work, that's when we're trying to create the situation where you're exposing the body to this highly acidic shutting down mode, but yet still able to generate or decelerate less is the way to think about it. So the be able to tolerate this flux of a lot of these metabolic waste products that are creating this acidic situation and yet still conditioning the body and the brain to not freak out as much and still create high force, high velocity contractions. And that's where you see people who don't condition themselves towards this have these humongous blowups, especially when you're going out at, you know, a pace and a velocity that's kind of faster than your norm or faster, which you've conditioned your body to run, quote unquote, aerobically. And you know, you got to remember the body is very good at recycling energy. And that's the whole aerobic argument or lactate dynamics argument is this recycling of energy. But at a certain point, it can't recycle trash. And so the way to think about running, say, marathon or even more aerobic type events is the you're running at a threshold where the body can recycle energy without creating a lot of trash. Versus when you're sprinting all out, it's creating trash and buildup, and it's going to have a stopgap point, and it can't use that anymore to create what you want, which is power. It says you need to just sit down and stop because we need to figure out a way to expel this interference that's now happening. And that's why, you know, side caveat, when you do acidosis tolerance work at really intensely, sometimes and most times athletes will vomit or if they had anything, because just trying to get everything it can out of the system, or they'll complain, oh man, I have a huge headache. Oh, I just have this, you know, and their heart's like throbbing in their head because the body's trying to figure out, we need to clear this stuff because we can't function. And it doesn't want to get to the point where it starts to seep into the heart and the heart can't function. The heart can't contract, right? And the heart stops. And that's really kind of what the mechanism, the alarm bell or safeguard mechanisms, you know, of the body and its interpretation of that situation, why it creates such a, you know, dramatic slowdown at the, you know, kind of like flip of a switch.
Exactly. And I think, you know, since we're going deep on this, I think it's important to note because I think terminology matters here. When we're talking about acidosis, we're talking about that pH kind of drop mm-hmm. and not the colloquial lactate acidosis.
And I want lactic acid. Yes.
That lactic acid, because this is important. And we'll dive into this really quickly. This is important. Lactate is not the thing that is causing the acidosis. It's actually, as we talked about in the wall episode, it's actually something that kind of helps and is it can be a fuel source to prevent some of this to happen. But to break it down pretty simply is, so we talked about ATP and ADP and phosphate. Every time ATP is broken down to ADP and phosphate, which is what you have to do to, you know, get that pulling of that myosin head, every time that happens, a like proton is released. Okay. So, or an ion, we'll call it.
Yes. Positive.
Yes.
Positive hydrogen ion.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Every time that happens, it's released. Okay. And if that accumulates, that's where you get that acidosis happening. Now, what happens is if we are supplying that energy, that ATP, through mitochondria, the mitochondria, aerobic respiration, takes up that hydrogen ion, that proton. Okay, it essentially says, oh, yep, here, I'm going to use this. Okay, so it doesn't accumulate in the cell, and because it doesn't accumulate in the muscle cell, it doesn't become acidic. Okay, but once the mitochondria, once we're running fast enough where we can't supply all the energy demands through this mitochondrial respiration, then those protons, that hydrogen ions, they accumulate, right? Because we can't clear that stuff out. We can't use it fast enough because we need energy from both aerobic and anaerobic sources. And that's where we get that acidosis. Lactate production tends to occur almost exactly with a one-to-one ratio of this hydrogen ion. So as hydrogen ions accumulate, lactate accumulation goes up and production goes up too. Why? Because it's essentially acting almost as a protective mechanism that like decreases the accumulation of these hydrogen ions, because it takes some of the burden off and says, all this anaerobic glycolysis that's going to pyruvate, and then eventually, you know, anaerobic glycolysis, all this stuff, this is going down a bad path. What we're going to do is create some lactate, which is going to buffer some of this hydrogen ion. And then this lactate can also be used in glycolysis itself, or at least the NAD going into it. So anyway, we've got this lactate almost acts as this like buffer to a degree that helps and isn't the hindrance. It just happens to occur at about the same time in the same ratio as this acidosis, which is where the original research, they saw lactate increasing, they saw pH dropping, and they're like, oh crap, it must be the lactate.
Right. Yeah. They didn't understand it was a cleaning, you know, a way to think about it, a helping mechanism, a helping thing, versus they just decide, oh, that was the boogeyman, right? And then it became this scapegoat for all your ills, essentially, in terms of training, DOMS, you know, fatigue, you name it, right? And that's one thing, great thing about science, we've advanced, and we know that that's not the case anymore.
Exactly. So I just want to set that stage. I know we went a little bit deep in there, but the point of this is to understand that it's not lactate. So stop using that term. Lactate occurs at the same time. So what does that mean? Measuring lactate, if you're into that, that's fine, because it almost acts as like, because it acts as this signal that tells you approximately how much acidosis there is, right?
Yeah, it's a symptom, but it's not the cause.
It's not the cause, but it's because we can measure it pretty easily. Mm-hmm. It allows you to assume that as lactate accumulation is going up, that means acidosis must be higher. That's why at the end of an 800, your lactate levels are, you know, 15 plus and through the roof. And at the, you know, in the middle of a marathon, they're two or three or four and not that high, right?
Right. And this is why the concept of aerobic conditioning, or actually like say, you know, lactate conditioning, tolerance threshold, whatever you want, makes sense, is because, again, we're trying to create the increase the capacity of the mitochondria to accept these positive H ions and put them through a recycling mechanism to create fuel, power, energy. However, one limiting factor, and again, it's not either or, but it's one of the contributing limiting factors to that slowdown, is when the mitochondria can no longer accept that positive H ion, it has to go somewhere, right? And this is what Steve talks about, the accumulation. Well, as we talked about, it accumulates and it spills into the bloodstream, and then it goes to the bloodstream to, you know, part of everything else, to the muscles. The muscles are working and said, I need fuel, I need oxygen, I need this, I need that. And now all of a sudden we're interjecting some toxin or the positive H ion, which the best way to think about it is it goes on the muscle belly and it just turns it off, right? You know, as Steve talked about the actin, myosin, the interference, it's just a turn off. So now we've turned off the ability of this fiber to contract. Well, you start doing that at really high rates with really quick, while your heart is pumping at near max, you know, maximum velocity, right? You have 190, 100, 200 beats per minute. Well, now you're flushing into the all your muscle bellies, this turn off, turn off, turn off. So then what happens, right? Well, your high threshold motor units, the ones you prefer to use, start to turn off. So then what do? You start to recruit those muscle fibers that you don't necessarily really use, those reserve ones, right? And then those start to turn off and down the food chain until, like, you sometimes see a collapse, right? When people go into a highly, highly acidic environment, because again, your body's trying to, you know, shunt this excessive waste product, this acidic product, to, you know, what it deems as non-essential functional muscle for life. So it's going to, its body's amazingly smart. So it's not going to, you know, it's going to go to the heart last, right? Because that's a really important muscle for sustaining life. So before you get there, it's just going to like filter it all to stop you from creating more of this situation, so it doesn't have to rest on cardiac muscles and turn those off. And this is an important way to think about it, because it explains why after someone is in that situation for the first time, especially your novice runner, like say in the 4x4 or four, open 4 or 8, and then the next day, like, oh, I'm so sore here and there, right? Because all of a sudden what happened was these new muscle fibers, you don't really use regularly in practice, had to be recruited as, you know, a secondary, tertiary option to sustain movement. And then now they become sore because it was the first time they were really, really recruited. But the thing to also understand is, like, and, you know, as Tony Holliner talks about a lot with his Feed the Cats phenomenon, because he uses work with sprinters, is this type of training, and we're going to get to this here shortly, this type of training you only can use probably maximum once a week, or, you know, maybe once every 10 days. Why? It is such an abrasive response to the body. It is so dang hard that if you put the body in that situation with more regularity, you're going to shoot up the sympathetic response. Cortisol is going to go through the roof. You're not going to recover as well. Your body is going to start kind of atrophying itself a little bit. Why? Because we don't want to be in an acidic environment in the body, right? A lot of chronic inflammation is because a lot of the foods, especially the processed foods that you know, we eat, creates a chronically acidic environment. And we're talking points of pH here, not one or two points. So recovery in a lot of ways, like whether it's massage, you know, hydration, sleep, those are all situations where the body gets to rebalance its pH, so to speak, and it flushes a lot of things out. But we have to understand, if you're chronically creating an acidic situation in the body, its response to training, its general health and well-being starts to become, starts to decline, right? And so that's one key reason why acidosis tolerance work is very limited in the amount of frequency you can safely use with it and get a positive training response. I mean, you'll get a training response to be maladaptive. And two, you know, if you're sitting here and you're worrying, well, they have a race and I do an Assos Tollens workout in a week. Is that ruining them? No, because in a racing situation, most likely they're only being exposed to that for about, 200 meters or less, right? So we're talking a handful of 40 seconds or less. When we do workouts, we're exposing them to minutes of this situation to create a tolerance to this. So it can not kind of like freak out, so to speak, when immediately this acidic situation arises. But again, you got to be super careful with how you administer it, with the dosage of this, because that is, it's better err on the side of caution than be too enthused about it. Because as we talked about, it can be interpreted as a very dangerous situation by the body.
Yeah, it's a potent adapter. I think we have to always remember is that the way the body tends to adapt is trying to survive and thrive.
Yeah.
which means like if you consistently expose it to this like highly acidic environment, your body's going to essentially be like, all right, how do we survive this?
Yeah.
And some of those survival mechanisms aren't conducive to performance to a degree. The other way I like to think of it is there's this inner kind of battle between this, should we use more aerobic stuff or aerobic mechanisms or anaerobic mechanisms to generate the energy that we need? And a lot of this is dependent on your level or activity of enzymes that are either supporting aerobic energy respiration or anaerobic respiration. And what tends to happen is if we do a ton of this acidic stuff, our body goes, oh crap, we've got to upregulate our anaerobic enzymes so that we can handle this load to a better degree, which is good to a degree. But if we go overboard on it, then what happens is you almost do that at the expense of those aerobic enzymes. Although it's not exactly like this, I like to think of it as they're competing a little bit for who sits in the first chair. And we need to have that balance right. Or else we're gonna, shift too far towards this like anaerobic side and produce more energy in that route before, we're ready to go. This is actually one of those things why Lydiard, if we go back to him, why he did his periodization the way that he did was in the sense he said, hey, I've got to essentially build up this aerobic side so high that even if it decreases a little bit during the sharpening phase of his training, where he was doing a lot of this kind of acidosis tolerance type work, that it doesn't like drop our aerobic side so far that now they're not incapable. In modern times, what we tend to do is instead of having these big blocks of, oh, I've got to build this so high and let it detrain a little bit, modern times, what we try and do is what John talked about. Instead of doing the Lydiard, hey, we're going to do 3 to 5 of these a week, right? Sometimes is what we're going to do is we're going to do this spread out and keep this balance of this aerobic anaerobic for the event. So our body doesn't like get overwhelmed and go mm-hmm. crazy.
Yeah. And I mean, for most of us, Lydiard enjoyed 6 months, right, in the purity phase of like building up these enzymes, mitochondrial, capillary development, like all these morphological changes in the body with kind of that hard lactate red lining running of 100 miles a week that's famous in the lore. But we don't necessarily have that luxury with a lot of the athletes we work with, especially in this classic system, especially in the high school system. So how do you then create a preparation, a tolerance for this situation, which is inescapable in especially the middle distance events and even to a certain degree kind of in the shorter aerobic events like the 5K and the 10K? Because you'll see it all the time, right? I'm reminded of this watching the 10Ks at NCAAs this week is like there's a good solid pack of like kind of the last chunk of runners, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, you know, coming into the last 600 or the bell. And then there's a shift in pace, right? From like, you know, the 10K rhythm or the kind of accelerating rhythm to then like the sprint rhythm, right? And there's just runners who just quote unquote can't change the gear, as we talk about, right? You go, oh, that's a speed problem. It is in some degree, but also it's a, like Steve said, the best way to think about aerobic and anaerobic metabolism is it's always happening concurrently with a, on a spectrum with a different weight being assigned to where the body is getting that fueling from. And so when you create that shift, you also have to create a training effect so the athlete's, you know, energy system knows how to shift to create more power, to create higher velocity contractions, and then also to use the fueling that's coming as well as the impending acidic environment that's coming in a way that's conducive to what we want, which is performing at a high level and, you know, sprinting down the home straightaway and hopefully, you know, winning or getting a podium position or what have you. So in order to, you know, create this situation, you don't need to do the long reps necessarily. Like, it's actually short reps, and we're talking maximum distance, 300 meters, with incomplete recoveries for a block of time. So the best way to think about it is, depending on your event and depending on how fast you want to try to train or prepare the athlete to go, you need to pick a kind of a velocity, right? You know, we could use the term critical velocity if you want, whatever. Just pick the velocity that you say, okay, in the end, when it comes to the final sprint in the, you know, 8, 15, whatever, how fast do we need to go? Does the athlete need to go to be competitive or, you know, put themselves in a competitive situation? Could be the answer is 55 seconds per quarter, 65 seconds, whatever. So then what you do is you say, okay, this is the speed. So you can then, you know, do design workouts in a couple of ways. The way I like to do it is, say, for like middle distance runners, here's a concrete example, is then create a situation where it's like cut down sprint reps with very, you know, short recovery. What I mean by cut down is like 250, 200, 150 with me, you know, going, you know, fast, like near sprinting, near max, with like something ridiculously short, like 90 seconds, 65 seconds recovery in between those reps, right? And here's why we take a little bit of recovery. We take a little bit of recovery. So a little bit of that, you know, kind of buffering and recycling, that clearance can happen, but it's incomplete recovery. So what ends up happening is the athletes meet the bear, hopefully at the same point in each rep. So ideally with that duration I gave you, the concept is to meet the bear at 50 meters. So about 6 to 7 seconds, right? So the first 250, they're going, they're sprinting, you know, and then boom, after about 30 seconds, 25 seconds, the bear kind of jumps on the back a little bit, but they can tolerate it. And then they do 150. Well, they go 100 meters or 200 meters, right? And then, or so then they go at 200. After 150 meters, boom, the bear jumps on their back again at about 50 meters to go. And then, boom, they go 150 meters, they go 100 meters, 12 seconds, 13, 14 seconds. Last 50 meters, the bear jumps on their back again. So ideally, the thing with Astos Tolerance work with I like to do is try to anticipate, based on the level's fitness, the athlete's fitness, is getting them to meet the bear at the same space every time. So they can be in a situation where they're decelerating, but their body is able to tolerate that. And then they're able to get comfortable with being uncomfortable and understand this is going to impendingly happen no matter what. And the reason we shorten the length of the rep, but keep the intensity at the same mark, is so that we create the situation where the intensity, the power production ask is at the same high velocity, you know, but because they are getting incomplete recoveries on 60 seconds, 90 seconds, whatever rest in between those reps in a set, that then, you know, we're trying to time when the bear jumps on their back. Now, if, say, you do that type of workout and then the bear starts jumping on the back earlier and earlier in the rep, so 80 meters out, 100 meters out, as you're shortening the length of the rep, that tells you that your recovery between the reps is too short for that athlete's current level of tolerance and conditioning. What you then need to do is afford, you know, a little bit longer rest interval. When we're talking rest, we're talking walk. We're not talking jog. We're talking standing. So that you can sync up the time better for when you want them to experience the bear. Because again, if they're starting the final rep, the 150, and the bear jumps on their back at 120 meters to go after 30 meters of power production, you're now not really training anything. You're actually creating a liability because you're asking them to go 120 meters in this turn-off state, this kind of highly discoordinated muscles shutting off. And so what's going to happen is the athlete's willful and wanting to do what you ask them to do, but you've now, as we talked about before, you're recruiting these secondary, tertiary, you know, and so on muscle fibers. And so you end up actually risking their like a pull, a strain, you know, as they're contorting and forcing their body to create power while all these muscle fibers are shutting off. And that's not what you want. So there's a degree of sophistication to get it right, because you need to understand what's the maximum duration that you can adequately subject this person to per rep. You know, to get the conditioning response we want. And for me, I like about 6 to 8 seconds max per rep. And if you just do the math, right, you're doing 8 seconds, 3 reps. All right, it's 24 seconds. Maybe you're doing 2 to 3 sets, you know, multiply that out. That's about 1 to 1.5 minutes max, which is a lot of training, a lot of exposure to this situation. But that's it. I mean, when you really think about it, it's if you're trying to, you know, get a lot of mileage in for a workout, this is not that type of workout to do it. It's high power, high velocity, but also high conditioning. You know, and yeah, afterwards you can do, say, like if the athlete's conditioned enough or seasoned enough, maybe some like tempo stuff, threshold, you know, lactate threshold work. So 1 mile repeats at 10K or 15K pace with 60 seconds rest or something like that. That could be a compliment, but 9 times out of 10, it's nothing. It's just, that's the day. Go do your cool down jog, call it good. And then you then have to build in probably about, depending on the athlete's level of conditioning and ability, anywhere from like 2 days to 3 days of pretty good recovery period for them to be able to process this. And this is why you tend to do this stuff, and it's called sharpening, as Lydia did. You tend to do this stuff in the later phase of the track season, kind of going into the final rounds of like championship racing, because you are giving that person naturally a lot of recovery, minimizing the fatigue component, but you're also infusing them with this tolerance work, which you only need to do about for 6 weeks. So you only need about 6 to 5 exposures, I found, before it starts to actually plateau and you don't get the training benefit anymore. So it doesn't need to be done year round, doesn't need to be done early in the season. It's just, it's one of those things you do in the final about 2 months of a track season to get the level of conditioning. And that's the hard part about it. It's like, as Steve and I always talk about, training's about balance, and it's knowing how much and how often to do it. And again, it's such potent medicine. Or the other way you can think about it, if you drink alcohol, it's like abstinence, right? A little bit goes a long way with abstinence. It's, you know, it's hard, hard, hard liquor. And you don't want to be doing it, you know, weekly or more than once or twice weekly, just because, again, the maladaptive effects on the body can just corrode what you've worked so hard to build in training.
Yeah, I'm glad you outlined some practical examples there with the workouts. I'm in agreement. I think if you spend, you know, acidosis type tolerance training like this is a potent medicine. And if we take it too often, it can have some negative effects, right? And one of the mistakes I see in this type of training is people just think the idea is, well, let's go and fall apart and then just like keep hammering and get there.
Keep pushing.
Acidosis as high as possible. Yeah. But what we're trying to do actually is gradually get the body to be able to adapt and take the mechanisms with it, or adapt to the mechanism, and then also sync up what you do mechanically with what's going on, you know, metabolically. And if we disconnect that, what tends to happen is people start to have really bad mechanical habits. This is why, if you've ever coached sprints or you've watched sprints or you've talked to your sprint coach, which highly recommend, is if you go to their practices, they'll shut things down a lot of times whenever an athlete starts compensating mechanically for some of this acidosis, for example, with their 400 runners, right? They'll shut athletes down once they start breaking down beyond a certain point. And you ask them why, and it's like, well, I'm ingraining bad mechanics. I'm ingraining bad habits for doing this stuff. So, and you can watch this in races too. If you want to know, okay, why do people, you know, why do their mechanics break down at the end of 800 when the bear jumped on their back? Well, it's almost like a survival mechanism, because what people are doing is consciously or subconsciously, they're realizing, oh my gosh, I'm losing force into the ground. I'm not putting as much into that. My muscles aren't contracting. So that's why a lot of times you see this wild swimming, like arm swings, because the arms, you know, can help dictate the force output a little bit. So they get big arms attempting to put more force into the ground, spend longer time on the ground, and they're attempting to compensate. But eventually that little bit of compensation can get you through things. A lot of compensation, it's almost like a leaky pipe. You just start leaking force all over the place, right?
Yeah, you don't get return. You produce force, but you don't get the return of the force. So it's a vicious cycle. You're producing more energy and contracting to create force, but yet you're not going as far. And then you just continue to go slide down that slippery slope.
Exactly. So what does that mean in terms of training? Is, you know, as a coach, when you're doing this sort of stuff, you really pay attention to how the athletes are looking and how they're responding. And don't become a slave to the workout that is written.
And it's not the time to get the miles in at all. Yeah. It's a time to get the stimulus in. That's it. And the stimulus can be had and digested and, you know, in a very short period. You may have written three sets and like by the end of the first set, it's kind of shaky. Like, in this is why I say, remember how long you want to expose them to that. So that's why, again, the preface of the period of the power production can be manipulated. I mean, if they're tying up and you had 250, 200, 150 row, you can easily just make it 150, you know, 120, 100, right? Because you're still getting that max power output and then meeting the bear at 50 meters to go. So don't think, oh, we gotta get this much mileage in. That's where we have the wrong mentality. And again, why we place this kind of in the performance period as we're getting ready and going into meets is because mileage doesn't matter in this situation. Duration, time of exposure, the right exposure is what matters. And again, as we talked about, it doesn't need to be a massive amount.
The other thing that I think is important to point out here when it comes to rest intervals is, as you shorten the rest, you are making things more aerobic, not anaerobic, more aerobic, because that rest is when like your body recovers and is able to recut, that anaerobic system is able to regenerate. If you don't give it enough time to regenerate a little bit, then you just start dipping more and more into the aerobic system, because our body goes like, well, we only had 60 seconds rest and this is rep number 5. Like, I got no time to like recover, regenerate and get my anaerobic system. So aerobic it is. And right. And that's fine if that's the purpose of the workout. But a lot of times we make the mistake and we say, oh, I'm going to keep these rest periods really short so that they will fall apart, which is true. But they're falling apart because at some point they're having like very little anaerobic contribution, so their aerobic system is trying to pull it all together, even though it can't produce enough, like it can't generate enough energy quick enough to supply for the pace needed, so you fall apart. This happens a lot when you do for example 10 by 400s with a minute rest. You know, by rep 7, 8, 9, like you're just, your anaerobic system's running on empty and you're gutting through it, and it looks like, oh, I'm falling apart and I'm super anaerobic, but your acidosis is high, but you're relying on your aerobic system because you haven't had that anaerobic energy contribution to be able to support it. So bottom line here is, okay, what are we talking about here? What does this mean? We have to find that balance of rest so that, no, we're not going to have our anaerobic system energy, you know, charge up fully after everyone, but we want it a little bit. So that, again, we can train this capacity to use anaerobic energy a little bit to top off our aerobic side, and then also deal with this acidosis holding things together. So it's really this kind of balance point of not only the distance that you're running, but also the recovery you give in between. And I should also point out, this is why, if you look at some training or Igloi, for example, sometimes between sets, he'd give, you know, very long rests, because he's saying we're going to give enough rest for this anaerobic system to come around, right?
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought the rest component, Steve. You know, the short rest I gave is just an example. Like, this is the art of it. You need to find the appropriate amount of rest for the level of athlete you're working with. You're working with younger athletes who have not had a lot of exposure to this type of stuff, then you might, you know, between reps in a set, take 2 minutes or something a little bit longer. But the rest that you take between sets is always full, 15 minutes to 8 minutes, depending on the athlete. Full. We're talking walking, we're talking sitting down, grabbing some Gatorade, whatever, like full. Because as Steve alluded to, you know, ATP can be produced via aerobic or anaerobic mechanisms. And, you know, we want to make sure we're conditioning the body to accept and create more of its production via the mechanism we want. Because remember, these mechanisms are always at play concurrently and happening at the same time. There's no separate one or the other. But there is a preference, a shift, right, towards where we're trying to extract that energy. And that's why I say you got to take the distance, mileage accumulation coach hat off. And you just have to say, all right, you're sitting down, full recovery. And the athlete will tell you when they're fully recovered, right? They'll have an appetite to do it again. But another thing to note too is when the athlete should complain of, oh, I got the severe headache. Or, oh, you know, or they vomit or dry heave. And then that might be a natural reaction. I've watched so many athletes vomit or dry heave in this type of work. That is a clear sign to shut the workout down, because they've reached their acidic limit to the point where their body doesn't know what to do with all that acidity, and they're trying to expel it any way it can. You know, that's the time to then do some aerobic type running, really easy jogging, because that stuff will help flush out the acidity that's happened. But remember, it's called acidosis tolerance. Not buffering, we're not clearing, we're just tolerating the condition. And you can build up a certain chemical tolerance to these flood of positive H ions in the muscle bellies by doing this work. But when you've crested that level of tolerance, it is time to shut things down. And some stimulus is better than no stimulus, but here, too much stimulus is worse than no stimulus. And we got to remember that with this type of work.
Yeah, you know, that's, and honestly, this is what makes training for the middle distance events really freaking difficult.
And that's why I love it. It's such a hard game. And I'll give you, before you go on, so I'll give a side caveat. Like Daniel Herrera, he ran a personal best, a slight personal best at the Stumptown Twilight, where Josh Kerr ran his 331. but and he, you know, because the pace was hot from the get-go. And like he went out and like he had a season's best in the eight, a season's best in the K, a season's best in the 1200, and then a season's best or a lifetime best in the 15, all in the same race, right? And it was the first time outside of an acidosis tolerance workout, I saw him just be like, whoa, I got to sit down, oh, you know, like curl up in a ball because his head was pounding. It's, oh, I got a headache. Oh, man. Because it was like the most highest potent injection of acidosis for 3 minutes and 39 seconds he'd been exposed to this season, right? But because we had done some tolerance work before, he could continue despite going out for him in 154 for the 800. He could continue producing force and power and not tie up and not have the bear jump on his back dramatically and get his butt to the finish line in, you know, personal best time for him. But without it, super shoes or no super shoes, it's not going to happen. And that's kind of, you know, just something to put out there. Like we're seeing with the super shoe phenomena, the distance events reaping a lot of benefits and people running outstanding wild times, like NCAA's men's 10K, right? It was like 10, 11, 12 people were under the old meet record, and like all these college kids running sub 28, which is fun to see. But the super shoe effect has a lot more influence there versus in the middle distances. If you don't do this type of work and have this condition, you can have all the super shoes in the world. You're just not getting bounced back off the track.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you gave that example because it it helps kind of bring this stuff home. And as I'm thinking about this again, when I'm looking at like 800 middle distance training, I think more than the workout like on paper that matters is like paying attention to your athletes. And when I've done this with my 800 athletes a lot, is I won't give them the full workout because I don't want them to know whether we're doing two sets, three sets, four sets, how many 200s, 150s, 120s, 100s, whatever it is. I do this almost based on like Igloi in the sense is I'll give them either one rep or one set at a time so that then that forces me to recalibrate during this stuff and make sure that I'm getting the, you know, the impact or the effect that I want to have. Because what I found in the past is it's really hard to predict breaking points. You know, it's really hard to predict when people are going to shut down and be done with. And even of athletes of similar abilities, this is really fascinating. If you have a bunch of 800 guys, similar abilities, is their breaking points will be different because they all have different tolerance levels. And this is where you get to see how people get to, for example, a couple of years ago, we had, gosh, what was it? Four guys who were 148, 149, all with, you know, four guys all within a second of each other in the 800. But you could see how they got to that point was different. Because if you put them through a tolerance session like you just outlined, maybe some 150s, near max, 90 seconds to 2 minutes, if I just gave them that, some would be breaking done at rep number four. Others could go to 7, 8 and be fine, right? And you say, well, wait a minute, they're all running the same time, right? Well, they're getting to that time using slightly different like strengths, right? One might be a little bit more aerobic, you know, and be able to supply a little bit more aerobic energy. So he might only have, we'll make this simple. He might only have like 6 seconds of this like bear on his back he has to deal with. And that's all he can tolerate. Another person might have like 10 seconds or 11 seconds. And again, I'm making these numbers up, but of this bear in this high ass acidic environment that he or she could tolerate. And it was fascinating and very clear, but it also reinforced the sense that I can't sit there and be like, oh, you run 150, so you're going to do this amount of 200s at this pace with this rest. I need to be responsive to understand, you know, where their specific capacities are so that I'm ensuring I'm training it in the appropriate way.
Yeah, I love that you brought that up because that's so important. When I have athletes do this work, everyone does it on their own, one person at a time. It's not like distance workouts where we all go together, because the goal is to run max velocity. And for someone, they can do it by themselves. Sprinters practice max velocity work all the time solo, right? Because it's your max velocity and it's your conditioning and tolerance to acidosis. Last thing you need is to be looking to your left and right and seeing what your teammate's doing, because it's such difficult work. And this is where it's so important and why we talk so much about the symptoms of what's happening, of what it looks like when the bear jumps on the back, and then what's internally the biology that is occurring. Because as a coach, you have to have a lot of nuance with this work, person to person, athlete to athlete. You can't just en masse give concrete numbers for your whole group of 800 meter runners or 1500 meter runners. So it's having a really open mind, but also a flexible mind about the goal is just to maximize, you know, and maybe just like an inch more, a second more here or there, their level of exposure to this type of situation so that they can create this tolerance. But if, like we said, it's such potent medicine that it's one of those things, a little can help you, but too much can really, really hurt you. And, you know, you, for each individual as a coach, you want to make sure you get the balance and the dosage just right. And that's what makes it so difficult. And I think sometimes why coaches, distance coaches, shy away from it, because you can't just say, all right, everyone's doing mile repeats and we'll call it a day. You know, you gotta be a little bit more, you know, in tune with each athlete, and then also sophisticated in your approach and know really what you're trying to get them ready for and how.
Yeah. Couldn't agree more. It's more, it's understanding of what is it you're trying to get ready for, and how are you going to accomplish that? As I sit here and think of, okay, we've gone over the bear, we've gone over the acidosis tolerance, what to look for. And I think this is one of those cases where the specific distance of the reps is less important than what's occurring on them. Any final thoughts or takeaways for our listeners as we, navigate this complex world?
I think, you know, one of the things to remember too is if you have like a high racing schedule where the athlete maybe is in, you know, in say the high school world, running open fours, open eights, 4x4s at duels, and then coming back and running an 8 or a 15 that weekend, you don't necessarily need to do this work because the race situation is the work. Mm-hmm. So that's one reason why high school kids get faster who just race a lot in a season in the middle distance events is because they just get more time exposed to this acidic situation, and they do adapt, thankfully. Like one of the things my high school coach did, and a lot of high school coaches do really intelligently, is, you know, was always made in early season, and also even mid-season, a distance runner 4x4 team, or through distance runners or middle distance runners on the 4x4 at the end of the meet. And so we'd have a B squad or what have you, because it was a fun way to get a little bit of this work in. You already did, like, say, your primary event, you know, or, you know, other events. But again, you had enough recovery, because you know, if you did an 8 or 15 earlier in the meet, you had, you know, 30 minutes, an hour, whatever. And so you could then just get a little micro dosage or exposure to this in a fun way with the 4x4, and really, you know, have the motivation to push through the bear, you know, or really start to recruit with the bear, because you're on a team. It wasn't just you, oh, I don't feel good, woe is me. You had this sense of, oh, I got the stick, I got to get it around as best I can to help the team. And he also made it really fun too, even if it was just distance runners who would, in the competitive scheme of things, get their doors blown off by the more seasoned 4x4 runners. But you know, that I think you have to remember too, is if you're in that situation and environment as a coach, then don't worry about like doing all this sophisticated work. It's or worrying about it too much, because it's kind of taking care of itself for the schedule of the season. Now, if you're more of like, you know, don't have that many races, or you're more of an NCAA or, you know, post-collegiate type coach where, you know, you're not going to be in that situation as much competitively from your competitive calendar. Yes. Then that's really where, like we said, the last 2 months of the season, you want to make sure you're getting frequent enough, about a week to 10 days dosage of this type of work, to prepare that athlete to have better tolerance when they do get in those higher level invites or championship level races.
100%. I think that's a good point. And on the flip side, I would say in the college setting is, don't forget that these high school kids, a lot of times had these 400, 800, et cetera, that satisfied some of these demands, which mm-hmm. a lot of times in college, we don't throw people into.
Right. In college, you kind of get in the trap of nowadays, you just run only like your primary event here or there. Or maybe you might run quote unquote an off event in an early season, like, you know, meet. And at some point, you know, sometimes we do, I think there's some training effect and hardening lost with the infrequency that people race nowadays. And, you know, there, that's probably not a podcast. because racing is really good training. But you just have to have enough maturity to know your early races aren't going to be these fantastic times. They're going to be these wow performances. But that's setting a stage up for later races when they are a lot, you know, more attractive times and a lot more potent competitive performances. So if you're not getting the stimulus via racing, that's where then you have to create that stimulus in training. But it's a little bit harder because in racing, the concept of racing is to give it your all most times, especially in the middle distance world. Versus in training, we tend to hold things back because we know, say, what the menu of training is. And that's really why, Steve, I like how you just dole out this type of work to those athletes, you know, kind of in fragments or segments, so that they don't put anything in reserve and actually maximize every step of the run. And that's something I also talk about a lot, is maximize every step of the run, whether it's a high velocity, high power situation in the beginning, and, you know, or maximizing the recruitment and trying to maintain coordination and coping mechanisms when you're in that highly acidic environment towards the end of the run. But if you just think about that, just maximize every step and not try to manufacture a time. I think that's the worst thing you can do, is like, oh, you ran the 150 in this, you ran the 250. Like, it doesn't really matter. It just matters that they went out full blast in the beginning and that they got the focus on the stimulus. So again, take the watch off as well for these types of work. Because again, it's not the point. It's not what we're trying to work. You're not trying to say, oh, I got better if I ran faster. Not necessarily. Like, you know, you'll get faster in the beginning portion. You get better. The way we know you get better is actually, and this is what I always do when I time these workouts, I have a cone kind of where I anticipate they will start to really, really have the bear jump on their back, 50 meters, 60 meters, 40 meters from whatever the finish line. And so if they're running 150s, they'll go 100 meters, and I'll time the first 100, like the quote-unquote fresh 100, when they're generating max power, max velocity. But I'll also time separately the last 50. The way you know they get better is when they decelerate less on the last 50 or the last portion of the workout, rather than run the first 100 faster or the whole split faster. So they could say run the first 100 all the time at, you know, 14 seconds, not an issue. If in the first runnings, they run the last 50 meters in 9 seconds, you know, and then it becomes 8 seconds, and then it becomes 7 seconds. Now we know we're getting better. So again, there's a degree of sophistication here. Don't look at the global time, look at the response to the stimulus through the lens of time, via less deceleration. And that is the key.
Love it. That's a great summary. So we've now given you a deep dive into the mechanisms of fatigue and acidosis, how it occurs, and what to do about it in terms of training. We hope you enjoyed this deep dive. If you
enjoyed, I did, man. I love when we nerd out like this. Yeah. Jeez.
If you did,
if anything else, I am satisfied.
Well, and that's all that matters, because John and I have no clue who listens, except that a lot of people do. But
we know, the people who tell us who listen. So thank you to everyone who listens and is listening.
Yes, you know what it is we've just been back to track meets, and normally we hear from listeners of the pods at random track meets, and that has been taken away from us for a while. So it'll be nice to get back out there. Anyways, thanks for listening. If you're interested in deep dives, again, check out the Scholar Program. Deep dives on all of this stuff. We go into the mechanics and science of fatigue, as well as the training and what to do about it. Check it out. And until next time, thanks again for being a part of this group, listening to John and I for years now. It's kind of unbelievable, but we value you, and thanks for being a part of this journey.